Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world. Missing Justice is an investigative true crime podcast from CBS News that examines the death of Christy Woodenthigh. On the night she was killed, Christy's family rushed to the scene in the Northern Cheyenne region and found no officers, no sirens, and no sign of Christy. This 6-episode series takes you inside what really happened that night and how the issues in Christy's case connect to the larger missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Listen to Missing Justice on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was not the full cavalry summit hoped for, but many people in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, were happy to learn that President Biden was there this morning on a surprise visit.
Joe Biden supports Ukraine, and it's very important for us, for our country.
A symbolic show of American support for Ukraine. It was nearly 1 year ago when the Russian invasion began, something many Ukrainians thought at the time would never happen.
How can war be here? We are living in civilization in a modern country.
I'm Marco Werman. We're also heading north of the U.S. border to a place in Canada where wild pigs are wreaking havoc on the environment.
The reality is you cannot barbecue your way out of a wild pig problem.
Too many pigs in the Canadian wild. All those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, broadcasting this week from WAMU in Washington. We're marking 1 year since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Today, the golden domes of St. Michael's Cathedral in the heart of Ukraine's capital with a backdrop. For a high-profile guest, President Joe Biden made an unannounced visit to Kyiv in advance of the anniversary to demonstrate American support for Ukraine.
1 year later, Kyiv stands, and Ukraine stands. Democracy stands. The Americans stand with you, and the world stands with you.
Biden wore a yellow and blue striped necktie, the colors of the Ukrainian flag, and he took a short stroll in the sunshine with his host, President Volodymyr Zelensky. The World's Carolyn Beeler joins me now from St. Michael's Cathedral in Kyiv to talk about the president's surprise visit. Hi, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco.
Biden spent several hours with Zelensky this morning. They also held a joint news conference. What was the substance of their discussions today?
Well, the two presidents visited St. Michael's Cathedral, which is an iconic landmark here, and laid two wreaths and held a moment of silence at the Wall of Remembrance, honoring Ukrainian soldiers killed since 2014. The substance, though, is that Biden announced an additional $500 million in U.S. assistance in ammunition, air surveillance radars, and other aid, but no new advanced weaponry, namely the long-range missiles and fighter jets that Kyiv has been asking for. As you mentioned, they held a joint press conference where Biden said Ukraine reminds us that freedom is priceless.
It's worth fighting for as long as it takes, and that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
We'll do it.
Zelensky there said, we'll do it, and then he in turn called this the most important visit in the history of U.S.-Ukrainian relations.
The
result of these visits will be felt on the field of battle, he's saying here, and with the strength of our soldiers to liberate our territory.
And Carolyn, what about the public reaction to Biden's visit today? What have you been hearing from people there in Kyiv?
It is hard to overstate just how excited Ukrainians were today that Biden made this visit during wartime. This afternoon, after his visit was made public, people showed up here in the square where I am now in front of St. Michael's Cathedral, hoping to catch a glimpse of him, or at the very least take part in a day that they were already calling historic. Among the people that visited were Oleksandr Velchev and Lesa Chernychuk.
It's a very good sign for our country that we understand that USA supports us, Joe Biden supports Ukraine, and it's very important for us, for our country.
I love Biden, точно.
Yes, thank you so much.
Да, phenomenal. що він з нами на все життя. І до перемоги, і після.
She's saying here Biden's always going to be with us before the victory and after. But, you know, Marco, when Biden told Zelensky that the U.S. is with Ukraine for as long as it takes, it did make me reflect on something I heard a couple of days ago from a dad here in Kyiv, who says when he hears that kind of a statement about a long-term commitment from Biden, he thinks that maybe his young son is going to be fighting in this war years from now. So people here definitely would like both this visit from Biden and some of the additional advanced weaponry that they believe will speed up this victory.
Mm. This was President Biden's first trip to Ukraine since the start of the war a year ago. It's a symbolic show of support in many ways, but how much does this kind of symbolism matter?
In this case, it really does matter. The very fact that Biden visited in the middle of a war when the airspace here is not secured, it's being seen as a victory in and of itself. Nikita Andreyash, who's just 15 years old and was actually in Kyiv for the first time while Biden visited, explained part of the significance to Ukrainians.
I think this is a historical moment. It's a gorgeous moment because 1 year ago, all the European presidents and US President Joe Biden too, he was calling to Zelensky and he was saying you need to exit from Ukraine, you need to go because it's dangerous there. But Zelensky, he answered, I don't need taxi, I need weapons. And it's past year and now Joe Biden here. I'm very proud of this. I'm very proud of my country.
Very proud of his country, he says.
The world's Carolyn Beeler in the heart of Kyiv, Ukraine. We're looking forward to your reporting all this week, Carolyn. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Next up for Joe Biden, Poland, a longtime U.S. ally and a member of NATO. Poland borders Ukraine and has taken in around 1.5 million displaced people in the last year. The Polish government says Ukrainians living in state-run accommodations will soon have to pay some rent. From Warsaw, our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
A 30-minute drive outside central Warsaw, there's a huge exhibition hall. It's an expo center that usually hosts trade fairs and conferences. But today, hundreds of camp beds are set up lying side by side. The building is home right now to 800 Ukrainians who fled their country in recent months. And there's little privacy. This is Natalia Zavalyonkova. She's a former history teacher from Mariupol. She tells me there are 8 people sleeping right next to each other in her small area. Zavalyonkova is holding a small plastic bag of her things as she talks to me. She says she keeps it with her at all times because she's afraid it'll be stolen. The centre has provided temporary shelter to more than 75,000 Ukrainians since Russia's invasion of Ukraine last February. There's a medical facility, a veterinary centre and a kids' playroom here.
We provide a safe space for kids where they can play, where they can spend some time, do their school exercises or do some sport and things like that.
This is Christina who runs the kids' room. She would only give me her first name for reasons of privacy. She tells me the number of Ukrainians arriving every day has fallen in recent months. But even with fewer people, life here isn't easy, she says.
Conditions here are really hard. There are no private space for kids even to do homework and exercises. And, you know, that's why like people who really care of their families, they try to get out from here as soon as possible.
The centre is government funded. But from March 1st, Ukrainians who are here longer than 4 months will have to pay for half of their accommodation and food costs. And after 6 months, that will go up to 75%. Anna Nachmilewska works with the Ocalenia Foundation, a support service for migrants and refugees in Poland. She says the government's new policy has already had an impact.
Because when people got the information that there's going to pay for the accommodation, some of them decided to go back to Ukraine because they know that they won't be able to pay.
The government says the new policy will save the Polish taxpayer from having to incur the full cost of housing Ukrainian refugees. But Nachmilewska says it might not be all about money.
I really think that it's going to be introduced because of the elections which are coming.
There's a general election in Poland later this year. And with high energy bills and soaring inflation, the ruling party's popularity has fallen in the polls. But not all non-governmental organisations in Poland are opposed to the government's plan to make Ukrainians pay for their upkeep.
The government cannot cover this for a very big period of time.
This is Dmitry Bielecki with Ukrainian House, a crisis response centre for Ukrainians in Poland.
People somehow need to deal with this situation, help themselves as well, and to find a way to start a small new chapter of their life.
Bielecki says many Ukrainians are now working full-time in Poland. But Anna Nachmilewska with the Ocalenia Foundation says it's not that easy for everyone to find work. Some people are still dealing with the trauma of the war, she says, and not everyone has sufficient Polish to be able to get a job. Back at the Warsaw Expo Centre, I ask history teacher Natalia Zawalionkowa what she plans to do next. She's waiting for a visa to go to Britain, she says, where a woman called Lisa has offered her a room in her house. But Zawalionkowa says that's not really where she wants to be. I want to go back home to Mariupol, she says. Back to the Azov Sea. I miss the sea, she says. For the World, I'm Orla Barry in Warsaw, Poland.
Picture your average barnyard pig. Smart, tame, domesticated. Now imagine a wild boar. Tusks snorting aggressively and ripping through the forest with a voracious appetite. In the 1980s in Canada, these two animals were deliberately mated to create a breed of so-called super pigs. Now they roam the Canadian plains, destroying crops as they go. Ryan Brook knows all about these super pigs. He leads the Canadian Wild Pig Research Project at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. Ryan joins us from his car as he's driving between North Dakota and Minnesota, where he's lecturing on the wild pig problem. Ryan, tell us some more about these so-called super pigs and where they came from.
The Canadian story started in the 1980s. We have no native pigs in Canada of any kind, but there was a big push through the 80s and 90s in Canada to diversify agriculture. We had to get away from cows and wheat, and we had emu ranches and elk farms, and of course, wild boar were brought over from Europe to be raised to be on the tables of the fancy restaurants across Canada. And so they brought them over and they were being raised. And one of the things the experts said is if you want a bigger pig, and in fact, a domestic pig has an extra set of ribs, as you get a longer animal, you get bigger young, more reproduction, all the benefits that we bred into these pink pigs we raised for pork, crossbreed them with a wild boar, and you'll get these much more productive pigs. And that's exactly what happened. And it worked great on the farm, except a lot of them escaped. And even worse, in 2001, the market peaked and then it just collapsed. And so people cut the fence and let them go.
Wow.
We literally get a week or more of 40 below weather with howling winds every year. And so the experts said, well, they're not going to survive a Canadian winter. What are you talking about? Well, they come from Siberia, and these animals are very, very well adapted. They have an incredible thick coat of hair and fur, and that gives a massive benefit to survive. A 638-pound pig is going to do a lot better out in the cold than an 80-pound pig by a long shot.
Yeah, survival of the fittest and survival of the fattest, apparently.
Yes.
Beyond the physical damage to their environment, I also wonder about the risk of disease from this hybridized super pig. Like, what's the risk if they become inadvertent and unmonitored sources of swine flu, for example?
Yeah, this is a huge point for sure. This is the one that turns my hair gray, is the disease side. There's a global crisis right now that's been going on for a while with respect to African swine fever. And there are lots of others like pseudorabies, like swine brucellosis. There's a long shopping list of things pigs can get. And because we know from tracking them with GPS satellite collars, we also know they travel very large distances.
As a Canadian researcher, Ryan, it's notable that today you're talking to audiences in North Dakota and Minnesota. What are you telling them?
You know, one of the things we often talk about is the fact that pigs can kind of move at two speeds. They move at about 4 or 5 miles an hour on foot, and they move about 65 miles an hour in the back of a pickup. And that's really sort of the two big risks that we think about when we talk about some of these northern U.S. states like Minnesota and here in North Dakota, is that people bringing pigs up from the southern U.S. in the back of a pickup truck to create hunting opportunities, and those on the hoof to cross the border from Canada.
Mm. So, Ryan, you must be giving some thought to solutions. What can we do about these super pigs?
Well, I think that there's a lot that can be done. And these big panel traps where you can capture an entire group of pigs at once is a really good tool. We also use helicopter very effectively to find and actually just capture and remove pigs as well. So toolbox approach is what I talk about. You have a whole, imagine your big red giant box in your garage full of every tool in the book. That's what we need for pigs.
Ryan Brook teaches at the University of Saskatchewan. He was speaking with us about the hybridized animals known as super pigs that are threatening crops in Canada and quickly becoming a concern in the northern U.S. Ryan, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Have a great day.
Just ahead on the show, we'll hear from one veteran fighter in Ukraine. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A year ago, on the eve of the invasion of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin had amassed tens of thousands of Russian troops near the borders. Inside Ukraine, the situation was understandably tense. Many people were concerned that something was going to happen. What exactly, though, was not clear. The World's Daniel Offman was in Ukraine a year ago, and he's back again, joining me from Kyiv. Take us back to the days just ahead of the Russian invasion, Daniel. What was the atmosphere there like, and what were people telling you?
Well, before the war, people here in Ukraine had some mixed feelings. On one hand, it was hard for people to believe that there would be a full-scale invasion by Russia into Ukraine. On the other hand, people were taking first aid classes, self-defense courses, preparing go bags, and evacuation plans in case they needed to flee. So I think people understood that they needed to prepare, but they couldn't imagine the scale of what would happen next.
You've stayed in touch with some of the people whom you met a year ago there, including one Ukrainian soldier you met in Kyiv. Tell us about him and what he's up to now.
Yeah, I've been in touch with Leonid Astaltsev. He began his service in Ukraine's military in 2014 when Russia initially invaded Ukraine. But after that, he continued supporting Ukraine's military and military veterans. He opened a pizzeria in Kyiv called Veterano Pizza. I just spoke with Astaltsev last week, but I also spoke with him about a year ago, and I asked him what might happen if Russia were to invade.
We'll have a phone call, and we will have instructions what we need to do and in what time. I think in one day we will be there, even less than one day.
Have there already been, like, I don't know, like warning messages or information that's come out recently?
No. And it will not be the warning messages. It will be one message. Go. And okay, we will go.
Now Astaltsev is serving in Ukraine's patrol police, which works closely with Ukraine's military. I met up again with Astaltsev in the southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv. I asked him to take me back to February 24th of last year.
First rockets start in 4:30 in the morning. My friend, the chief of patrol police of Kyiv, he called me and he said, "Can you come to us? We will fight for the Kyiv and we need you." The army gave us time to create a few waves of defending forces, and we were thinking that it will be a battle for Kyiv. But our Ukrainian armed forces, they do their job so good that no one were in Kyiv.
So Leonid, after Kyiv, you went to the east of the Donbass. What was your team's role there?
On Donbass, we were taking missions about the evacuation because they're waiting until Russians almost came into their villages, cities, and after that they call and say, "We need evacuation." And we have to take these idiots and deliver them in a safe places. We're going into city in which there is a battle between Ukrainian army regular and mother. But it was not difficult. It's okay.
But still, during these missions, as you said, you're going in the middle of a battle and you're encountering fire.
It's a work. We are having simple work. Every infantryman, which are now on the front line, it's like, it's not a work, you know.
You've seen a fair amount. You've been to the front lines. What is the number one need right now of the Ukrainian military?
I think nuclear weapon. You know, we need for today the heavy military things. We need tanks, we need big guns, we need artillery. Because you can be anyone, but 120 millimeters don't give a shit about who you are. It will kill you.
What's your assessment of what you've seen from Russia's military?
They are becoming smarter, more accurate in what they do and how they do. 4 months ago, here in this place on the south, we trying to find the enemy positions, and it was like tanks, BMP, people. It's like, you know, you have so many opportunities to kill this motherfucker. So now we don't see anyone because they were hiding. They were want to leave. This is not good, you know, for us.
It's been already a year almost since the full-scale invasion. What has this year been like for you? And what are your hopes for the next year?
You know, I don't have any hopes. It's a war and it can be anything. So the most important things for me, it's safety of my family, my ex-wife and my son. We have very good relationships between each other. We are friends. And for me, it's very important to understand that they are safe. On the first day invasion, I called Ira, it's my ex-wife, in 4:15, and I say, go. And she have a car, she grabs sun, she grabs some stuff, she grabs garbage, yeah, and just go to the Poland, Germany, Netherlands, and after that they went to the England. The garbage she put out of a car, I think in Germany. Yeah. But it's important because I understand that they are safe.
One of the last times we spoke, you told me that between 2014 and 2015, 7 people in your unit died, unfortunately. Do you know people either from your unit or other friends who have died as a result of the war?
Of course. My friend with which were opening first pizzeria, he was like a big brother for me in a business of pizzeria because he taught me how to do pizza, Rafael Agaev. He was killed in Mariupol. He was in the Marines. Very cool guy, which were friend of mine, Alexei Chubashev. He were doing a best program military about the recruiting on the special forces. 2 more guys, it's Vanya. He had a pizzeria in Abalone, a veteran of pizza. He was killed in action in Severodonetsk. We have Alexei from Nikolaev. Here was veteran point, a cafe. And he and his wife were the owners, and he were killed in action 2nd month of the war. Another people, which I were knew them, but they died.
How do you cope? How do you process so much loss?
You need to work. Yeah, for me, it's the most important thing today. It's kill mother. If I can't kill them now, and if we can't kill them now, we need to educate ourselves how we can do this more effective.
I want to ask you about friendship. Mm-hmm. You've become close friends with some people. It's a difficult time, but how have you developed these kind of friendships from the war, and what do they mean to you at this time?
The people which are fighting with me, it's not a friend. It's a brothers in arms, very good war, because it's not a friend, it's not a family, it's something else, it's something more strong. Because we are living together, we're fighting together, we are losing together, we're winning together. When you understand that you can die, when you understand that people from the left and from the right, they will help you if someone wants to kill you, it's like another level.
Leonid Ostaltsev there. He serves in Ukraine's patrol police. He was speaking with The World's Daniel Hoffman in the southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv. You're listening to The World. The Biden administration says the Kremlin miscalculated U.S. resolve for supporting Ukraine. The war could end very quickly, says the American ambassador to the U.N. That's entirely up to the man who started it, Vladimir Putin.
He can end it tomorrow by pulling his troops out of Ukraine.
More from Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield in a few minutes here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The single country that is home to the largest number of refugees in the world, that would be Turkey. When it comes to just Syrians, there are around 3.5 million living in Turkey. They have not always been welcomed with open arms. Today, yet another powerful quake on the border of Turkey and Syria, causing panic and further damaging buildings. It was just 2 weeks ago that 2 massive earthquakes killed more than 45,000 people in the region. Syrians living in Turkey say they quickly became scapegoats and that the hostility toward them is growing. Fariba Nawa reports from Istanbul.
Right after the earthquake struck, there was a welcome solidarity among Syrians and Turks in Gaziantep, one of the cities hit hard in southeast Turkey. Close to 1 million Syrian refugees live in Gaziantep, and they huddled alongside Turks in gymnasiums and parking lots, sharing bread, water, and heat. But tensions soon began to rise. Nur Haki is a translator and resident of Istanbul. She was visiting her Syrian family in Gaziantep when the earthquake struck.
All of us were sleeping. It was 4:17. And then, like, suddenly I started hearing the noises of all the glasses in the house, you know, breaking. It's, you know, like those doomsday films where you hear, like, things, like, breaking and moving.
Haki says her family of seven fled their third-floor apartment and found shelter in a school gym. She says there was a few arguments in the gym, but Turks and Syrians tolerated each other. The Haki's Turkish neighbors kept checking on them. But things took a turn when they joined others attempting to evacuate the city because of ongoing aftershocks. Haki went to the bus station and asked a bus driver about the roads.
They said, "What nationality are the people going?" We said, "Turks and Syrians." This man, he said, "No, Syrians cannot go in the trip, only the Turks."
Haki's family eventually left Gaziantep by car, once they found enough fuel to fill a gas tank. She says she experiences a lot of discrimination in Turkey, but after the earthquake, it's gotten worse, and she's noticed a pattern in her interactions.
If you don't have a relationship and they see you from afar, you are the enemy. It's either you are part of them and they know you very well and they treat you very well, or you are the enemy. There's no place in between.
Disinformation has been circulating on social media about Syrians and other refugees. They're accused of looting damaged shops and homes. Hashtags like, "We don't want Syrians here," have been trending on Turkish Twitter. One Turk wrote, "Quake survivors are welcome to stay in my Ankara home for a year, on condition that they're not Syrian." And some Turkish politicians, like far-right leader Umit Özdağ, are adding fuel to the fire. Omar Kadkoy, a Syrian expert on migration with the Economic Policy Research Foundation of Turkey, believes Özdağ's rumor-mongering has contributed to recent violence against Syrians. Authorities have arrested some of the people spreading false information, but they're not going after politicians like Özdağ.
So why would you not interrogate this politician for all of this information that he has been spreading, whereas you just, like, you know, go with maybe less valuable figures in the situation? That's a big question mark for me, because the government is just not doing anything about that.
That might not be entirely surprising. In the run-up to elections taking place this spring, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling party have promised to deport more refugees. Turks point to the $40 billion the government has spent on Syrian refugees over the past decade and say these immigrants are taking Turkish jobs and homes. But the new generation of Syrian refugees only know Turkey as their home, and the racism they face is hard to understand.
En yakın arkadaşım bana Instagram'dan bir paylaşım paylaştı.
Tina Ibrahim, a nursing student, was 9 when her family fled Syria and settled in Istanbul. She just turned 21, and most of her friends are Turkish. But one of them shared an Instagram post that said the refugees should go, and their homes should be given to those whose homes were destroyed by the earthquakes.
Eğer o arkadaş beni sevseydi, beni düşünseydi,
if that friend really cared about me and loved me, she wouldn't have sent me the post, Ibrahim says. After a good cry, she's decided to ignore the woman. Instead, Ibrahim says, she'll invest in Turkish friends who will support and comfort her as a Syrian. For The World, I'm Fariba Noah in Istanbul.
All this week, we're marking 1 year since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, a year that has not followed some of the predictions. 12 months ago, many U.S. officials were assuming that the Russian military would decisively roll over Ukraine. That did not happen. There was also a lot of reluctance in Washington to send sophisticated weapon systems to Ukraine in order to avoid direct conflict with Russia. But today, U.S. military aid to Ukraine is measured in the tens of billions. That includes the Patriot air defense system, armored fighting vehicles, even Abrams tanks. So what lies behind the shift in policy?
We have not wanted to directly engage the Russians on the war, but we are directly and aggressively supporting Ukraine's efforts to defend itself and to defend all of us.
That's the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. When we spoke last week, I asked her to describe how U.S. officials saw this conflict a year ago and to explain why the thinking about the war has changed so dramatically.
Well, 1 year ago, we were ringing the alarm on what we saw happening in Ukraine. 1 year ago, Secretary Blinken was here in New York, sitting in the Security Council, warning the world about what we saw happening in Ukraine. So we took this seriously from day one, and we've taken it seriously throughout. We have been very, very clear that we support Ukraine, and we have supported them even before the war. We'd given Ukraine close to $1 billion before the war started to help them to defend themselves. So there was never any question in our mind about supporting the Ukrainian efforts to defend themselves against Russia's aggression. The Russians miscalculated severely what happened. They miscalculated our support for Ukraine. They miscalculated the unity of Europe in support of Ukraine. They miscalculated on NATO, and they definitely miscalculated on Ukraine's resolve to defend itself. And we have committed to defending them and supporting them until this war ends.
So despite that initial kind of support, the West was in the beginning very cautious about provoking Russia and assessing how much to support Ukraine. The whole war is defying expectations. How do Ukraine's allies decide what they're willing to do next, what the U.S. is willing to do next, and for how long?
As the president said, we're going to be there as long as we're needed. And I think the world is seeing Russia's aggression for what it is. It's a bold and really aggressive effort to change the borders of a country. They are going against everything that the UN Charter stands for. And the world is witnessing it in real time. And Russia has been isolated because of these actions, and they will continue to be isolated until they make the decision to withdraw their troops from Ukraine and end this war. But I will tell you that, Marcos, the diplomatic efforts prior to the war were intense. President Biden himself reached out to Putin. Secretary Blinken had a meeting scheduled with Lavrov the day the war started. So we did not ignore trying to find a peaceful path to addressing the situation. But Russia wanted to go to war. They wanted to bring or attempt to bring Ukraine down to their knees, and they failed.
Ukraine is on the verge of proposing, as you know, for the sixth time a UN resolution calling for a just peace and territorial integrity for the country. The most recent resolution in November passed with 73 abstentions. That's a lot of countries on the fence. How do you explain that?
But there were a lot of countries who actually stood up in support of Ukraine. And they continue. As you may know, we got 141 countries out of 193 to condemn Russia's actions in Ukraine. We got 143 countries that condemn their attempted annexations in Ukraine. We got full support for kicking Russia off of the Human Rights Council. So while there are countries who abstain and they can explain to you what they're doing, what we're standing for is what the UN Charter stands for. We're standing for peace and security. And that is what we encourage other countries to do as well.
I mean, 73 abstentions, though, that does not suggest global unity against Russia. Many governments in Africa, Latin America, and Asia have refused to speak up against Russian aggression. Why is that?
Five countries, including Russia, voted with Russia. We're not telling countries how to vote. We're encouraging them to support Ukraine's efforts to condemn Russia. But the overwhelming number of countries have express support for Ukraine. And those who abstain, you can discuss with them why they made the decision to abstain. But what we're hearing, even from those countries who abstain, we're hearing that they do not support Russia's aggression against Ukraine.
Final question, Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. I think, you know, for many people, experts, the big puzzle is assessing what Vladimir Putin wants. And that kind of comes to an assessment of his mindset when it comes to this whole invasion, this whole conflict. What would he do if he was faced with defeat in Ukraine, do you think?
I can't speak for President Putin. You have to talk to him about what he wants, but he has to hear what we want. And what we want is to defend Ukraine against his aggression. And I think the whole world is there. The whole world has called for an end to this war, an end to Russia's aggression. And he can end it tomorrow by pulling his troops out of Ukraine. And he can end it tomorrow by accepting that it is unconscionable for him to carry out the kinds of attacks against civilian infrastructure and the kind of killing and human rights violations and war crimes that he's committing inside of Ukraine.
In the halls of the UN, though, Ambassador, doesn't that question, what would Putin do if he faced defeat in this war, doesn't that question get a lot of focus?
I think people are concerned about what Putin will do because they've seen what Putin has done. And that's why it's important that all of the countries who continue to have discussions with President Putin, implore him to stop this brutal war.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
When Russia attacked Ukraine and annexed Crimea back in 2014, a lot of the world condemned it, but not much was done to stop it. For Ukrainians, that moment was the start of the war with Russia, but many still did not think that Moscow would actually launch a full-scale invasion of their country, which is exactly what happened on February 24th last year. Corey Valencourt of Smoky Mountain News was recently in the Ukrainian city of Odessa, where he spoke with people about what they were doing and thinking on the eve of the invasion, and then after.
My name is Marina Zabgaeva. Odessa is located near the Black Sea. When I was small, all the time, every week, we were going with my parents to the sea. I was sitting with my friends. We had tea, sweets, nice conversations, candles. They were talking about what will be if the war will start.
My name is Alexander Slavsky. I am head of the State Property Foundation of Ukraine's regional office in Odessa and Mykolaiv. Before the war, in December 2021, Territorial Defense asked me to help them find buildings for their location. We provided a couple of meetings with a businessman for finding places for them and support for Territorial Defense.
One of my friends, she was, you can say, in the panic, and she said, I cannot hear this. If something will happen, I need to go. And I was sitting there with her and thinking, the war, how can war be here? We are living in civilization, in a modern country, in the Europe. How can be something like this?
We organized a meeting with the Odessa Business Club on the 23rd of February at 6 or 7 p.m., just a couple of hours before the war started.
And on 24th, approximately at 5 a.m., I woke up from air defense, which shooted the rocket right above my house. I saw the light, and then that time everything started.
We didn't understand until the end how fast the war would start. We were drinking coffee and then thinking maybe we should even try champagne.
My name is Mary. I was an English teacher. I was a tutor for little kids. I was in my apartment. When I woke up, I opened my eyes and I saw my husband. He came close to me, he sat on the side of the bed, and he looked with a pity to me and said, you know, the war started.
It wasn't clear how fast Russians would come to Odessa. Could they come to Odessa? How soon would fighting in the city begin? We were preparing for the worst.
I was trying to be very brave. I collected the things that I believe were very necessary, precious things that I believe I can exchange later for food, for electricity, for whatever.
I was always repeating in my head, you know, in Frozen, there is a song where the girl is singing the next right thing to do. So you cannot skip the war, but the only thing you can do is the next right thing to do. So I figured out I need to find a job for myself in order to donate more. Don't ask what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. So that was the only thing I was thinking about.
I will remind you, there are millions of citizens in Odessa, and there are hundreds of thousands or even millions of people suffering from military conflict, driven into a humanitarian catastrophe by the deeds of the Russian military through unprovoked aggression.
I saw people destroyed. People suffered so long and so much, they lost themselves. They lost their identity. If they can go fight, they should do this. If they can earn money and donate, they should do this. I think this is the duty of each Ukrainian.
That story was produced by Corey Valencourt. In Odessa, he spoke with Marina Zavgayeva, Alexander Slavsky, and Maria Bulgar. We'll have more voices and stories all this week from Ukraine. King Charles' wife, Camilla, the Queen Consort of England, grabbed some headlines recently. The palace has announced that the Koh-i-Noor diamond will not be part of her crown. The Koh-i-Noor is one of the largest diamonds in the world, and it's got a deep history in India. It came into the possession of the British monarchy in the late 1800s, was associated with Queen Victoria, and has been a feature in the crown of the Queen Consort ever since. But at King Charles' coronation in May, it will not be on display. To explain why, we reached out to Anita Anand. She's a podcaster and author of several books, including Koh-i-Noor, The History of the World's Most Infamous Diamond. Before we get to the royal family's decision, Anita, can you first tell us briefly about the origins of the Koh-i-Noor? Like, where did it come from?
We first see it in the historical record. And I guess, Marco, that's what you mean, is like, when do we actually see it from an eyewitness who writes it down on paper?
Yeah, like when it was dug up.
Dug up, we don't know. And it wasn't dug up. You'll have an idea of like something like Lord of the Rings, where you've got all the dwarves working at a mine to dig up jewels. That's not how this diamond was born. So until the diamond mines of the 17th century were discovered in Brazil, all big diamonds came from India. Mm. And they weren't dug out of rock like we could imagine today, you know, some Indiana Jones kind of film, but they were pushed up through soft alluvial sand from rivers. And often these teeny tiny little crystals, octahedral crystals, which came up. But every so often you'd have a whopper. And the biggest whopper of all was the Koh-i-Noor that gets pushed up at some point from a riverbank, probably in Golconda. That's all we can say. We do know that the first time it's written about, it's a lot bigger than the jewel that everybody's fighting over today.
Was it cut? Is that why it was so large?
So it comes out as a hunk a chunk of rock, first of all. And then the Mughals, that's when we first get to hear about it, when it's written about as part of the treasury of a man called Shah Jahan. Now, you probably don't know his name, but I guarantee, Marco, you know his greatest hit. It's the Taj Mahal, right?
Right.
So Shah Jahan is famous for the Taj Mahal. He also created something called the Peacock Throne, which is like this jewel-encrusted throne, which looks actually more like an ice cream kiosk than the kind of throne that you and I might imagine today. But on top of that throne is the first mention of the Mountain of Light, the Koh-i-Noor diamond. And we know what it looks like from then because people sketched it. And it looked very much in the Mughal style, not like it is today, but a big, hefty rock with a flat top and very roughly hewn sides, which is what the Mughals liked. And so that's the first concrete mention of the Koh-i-Noor. And from there on, we can trace its very bloody relay race through history, because the Mughals hang on to it for a couple of hundred years, but then it passes through the Persians and then through Afghanistan and then back to India, the place of its birth. And this is where the controversy of today comes from, because it's the way in which it passed from India to British hands that raises all the political upheaval of today.
Right. So let's talk about that. How did the Koh-i-Noor diamond end up in the possession of and worn by Queen Victoria?
So when it was owned by India again, after this long voyage through different dynasties, and by the way, that voyage makes anything that you've ever seen in Game of Thrones seem tame. So anyway, it is being held by the Sikh Maharaja Ranjit Singh, who is the only man who sort of dies peacefully without his kingdom being reduced to ashes in the 1830s. And the throne and the crown and the diamond all past his five-year-old son, a little boy called Duleep Singh, in 1839, who, as soon as he comes into power in the north of India, in this place called Punjab, all hell breaks loose because the Brits have been trying to get a hold of this area. It's strategically really important. It's very close to Russia. It's rich in gold and jewels and wheat, very significantly. It's still known as the breadbasket of India. And so they've been trying and failing to get a foothold. But when this little boy is on the throne, with his mother reigning with him, they see their chance. And according to Indian historians, there are two very largely manufactured Anglo-Sikh wars. They then come in, they sign a treaty of friendship, first of all, with this little boy king in 1846, and say, look, you know, we'll look after you. There's an awful lot of trouble you're coming your way. But then what they do is they separate the little boy from his mother. So she's dragged away, she's locked in a tower. He's then separated slowly from everybody he trusts until he's surrounded by men whose language he doesn't speak, people who have taken his mother away. He's all alone and friendless. The second Anglo-Sikh war rages, and he's told, look, if you want your life to be saved, then you sign this piece of paper, or vellum, as it would have been in those days, which signs away his kingdom, his future, and his Kohinoor diamond. And this happens in 1847 when he's 9 years old. So he's a little boy. And that's why this has become a symbol for India's humiliation under the Raj. It's become so much more than a Punjabi story. Mm-hmm. It's become a talisman of colonial loot.
What an incredible story. What would you say is the message the monarchy is sending by saying the diamond will not feature in Camilla's crown?
Well, I mean, the diamond has never been worn after Victoria by any reigning monarch. It's always gone to the consort or the wife. And I don't know, Marco, whether the thinking is that wives are expendable, but that's the way it's always gone. More recently, India has been, particularly under Narendra Modi, very keen to portray itself as not the victim of empire. You know, this idea that a small island nation could reign over a mighty country like India in the Modi narrative is unacceptable. So there's been a lot of mood music that you really shouldn't wear this on coronation day. So you had somebody from the BJP party, this is Narendra Modi's party, saying, look, if Camilla wears the Kohinoor, and these are his words, it could transport us back to the days of the British Empire in India. Which is not a good thing, clearly. That's the message. And even more explicitly, a few months later, Narendra Modi's government said they would do everything in their power to amicably encourage the British to give back the gem.
I mean, partly because of its circuitous route and brutal fight for ownership of the diamond over the years in places that preceded the nation state. The Kohinoor has also been claimed by Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, even the Taliban have said it's theirs. What's the chance a stone will one day be returned to India?
David Cameron, a former Prime Minister of Great Britain, put it most succinctly, which is like, no chance, to paraphrase. And I think he went further in saying, if we give back the diamond, where does it end? And all the museums of London will empty. This was a gem of the Durbar, which is based in Lahore, you know, when the Sikh king ruled. So Pakistan made a formal request for it in 1976. The father of Benazir Bhutto, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, made the claim, saying, look, actually, it's a Lahore gem, give it back. And he was turned down flat. And every other approach has been turned down flat. So I think that's always been the reason given that it cannot be repatriated, even if there was a will. And there's never even been a will, to be honest with you. So that is always the reason given, is who do we give it back to? And I think that will always be the reason that is given, that, you know, who exactly do we give it back to? But by not wearing it at the coronation, let's put it this way, a diplomatic grenade has certainly been diffused for the time being.
Anita Anand is the host of the Empire podcast. She's also the author of several books, including Kohinoor, The History of the World's Most Infamous Diamond. Anita joined us from London. Thank you so much. This was fascinating.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, and all this week from WAMU in Washington. We're online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks very much for listening.
This past year, listeners continue to show their unwavering support of The World. Together, we raised over $67,000. We're grateful to the following people that helped us reach our goal. Aaron Scheinberg, Lori Bergner, Mark McCaffrey, Kimberly Smith, Nayal Brennan, Gina Luch, Leslie Miller, Andre Kuzmirtz, Christine DeCourtney, Joshua Nero. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners around the world.